Welcome to everyone. I want to thank each and every one of you for committing the time that you do as volunteer members of the Public Health Advisory Council. And it's just a pleasure working with all of you. So thank you for being here, making time for this. I have the opportunity to reference something that we've been hearing about, learning from the House Bill 1152. There are many opportunities embedded in that legislation, and I think that this coming year we're going to really learn a lot more about that. And tonight, Dr. Melnick is also going to share some information. So before I do the roll call, I wanted to take the opportunity to say that one of the opportunities that's coming to us because of it is that we will be having a member of the Board of Health for Clark County be a member of our Public Health Advisory Council. And I have the pleasure of getting to introduce you to her right now. So her name is Karen Bowerman. She serves as a council member for the 3rd District and also is now chair of the council and the Board of Health. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about her, but I would really encourage you to go online and look at the Board of Health and the County Council information about the members and read about her, because I'm very impressed with the kind of experience and principles and dedication that she brings to her work and now to us as a member of our Public Health Advisory Council. So I did a little reading, and I discovered that the first thing that jumped out at me is that Karen Bowerman is a values-driven leader. And that is a really important thing in today's world, because it's not just how much you know, but it's what you do with what you know, and also how much you care. And the values that she called out in what I read about her were family, education, service, patriotism, and faith. And she speaks about each one of those things, and I encourage you to look at it, because I found it very inspiring, and it helped me feel like I knew her a bit personally. So that was wonderful. So Karen brings over 40 years of experience in business from every angle, having a career as dean and professor of business, and now dean emeritus of the College of Business and Public Administration at California State University in San Bernardino. And she's had many, many, and continues to have many other activities in the business world and in service and in government, as you know. I'm going to tell you a little bit about her education, because I was wondering how she could get all that done in the time that she's done it all. She earned a PhD in administration at Texas A&M University, this distinguished graduate for academic achievement, professor dedication, and service to her fellow students. She has a master's in speech, communications, and human relations at Kansas University, and a bachelor in both political science and speech at Wichita State University. And so that I could go on a long time, but I know we don't have that kind of time. So I just want to share with you that probably the most impressive thing I saw in terms of her service and her activities in her community is the amount of community service she has in her repertoire. It tells me that she's a person that looks beyond her own self-interest quite a lot beyond, and takes a great interest in the people that she serves and the people in her community and the people that she cares about and the people that she doesn't even know. So with that, I'll just say thank you for attending our meetings this coming year, Councillor Bowerman. And would you like to share a few words with our group, and that maybe we'll help them get to know you a little bit more?
Carla and I were just saying that we're going to discover together what the nature of this liaison role is. So you can tell me as we go along how I could be of any value to this group. The main thing that I would like to do tonight is listen. I expect that an advisory committee is going to be really out there with some solid opinions and direction, not just for Dr. Melnick, but for your Board of Health, too. And I look forward to that. And with whatever my role of carrying those ideas back or whatever, but being with tonight, I just, Robert, would you mind giving that introduction once more? No, I'm just kidding. That was absolutely beautifully done. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, and I thank you for that, Marla.
You're welcome, and the pleasure is ours. We're grateful to have you here. Thank you. So I will now go through the roll call. So what I would ask of you is if you would just say present when I call your name. They're not in alphabetical order. I just printed off the most recent one on the website because we've had so many changes in the last couple, 3 months. So if I do not call your name when I get to the end of my list, please say something so we can get you on here, make sure that we have you on the list. So I'll start with Michelle Stickley.
Here.
Present. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And also, Michelle, would you please, and the rest of you also, please just briefly say what your role is, the business or organization that you represent, or what your role is on the council. Michelle, would you please share that?
Sure. I am on the executive council as the Weathers Moray something community liaison, I think. Is that what my role is, Helen?
Yeah, I believe that's correct.
Okay. Thank you. I'm also with LULAC, so thank you.
Great. That's helpful. Sandy Brown.
I represent Consumers for Public Interest, and I also sit on the executive committee.
Thank you. Elma Blum.
Hi, I'm here. I represent the non-elected representative for the city of Vancouver. I live in the Rose Village neighborhood.
Thank you. Paul Childers.
Here, present, and I represent the restaurants of Clark County.
Thank you, Paul. Mark Collier. Oh, you're on mute, Mark.
Hi. President, I represent Stephanie Installers, Designers, and Operation Maintenance Specialists.
Great. Thank you. Heather Decker.
Present, and I represent Legacy Salmon Creek Medical Center.
Thank you. Remy Youssen.
Here, and I represent the Dental Society here in Clark County.
Thank you. Adrian Fairbanks.
Hi there. I'm Adrienne Fairbanks. I'm present. I'm a veterinarian in Clark County and represent veterinarians on the council.
Thank you. And Dave Fuller.
Good evening. I'm Dave Fuller. I'm the director at CRESA and representing emergency management.
Thank you. Peggy Carlson.
Good evening. I'm present and I am the education representative.
Thank you. Andy Santos. Don't see Andy, so hopefully he'll chime in before we get started. Shona Carter.
Hi, I'm by phone. I am with the Community Foundation for Southwest Washington. I'm a community liaison.
Thank you. And we have one vacancy on our council, and that is the Peace Health Southwest Medical Center representative. So we're recruiting for that position. The next one I have is John Brooks. I don't see John's name, so we'll keep going. Stephanie Royce Yamashita. Let's see, Stephanie. Tyler Clary.
Present, and I am the drinking water utility representative for Clark County.
Thank you, Tyler. I am Marla Sanger, a consumer of public health services and on the executive committee, but outgoing after 3 years, so really enjoying it. And the next person is Maria Swinger-Inskeep.
Present. Good evening. I am with the City of La Center, where I serve as the Director of Administrative Services, and I represent the non-elected for all of the cities except for Vancouver. And welcome, Karen, and I have to say Rock Chalk Jayhawk. I used to work there and got my MBA from there.
Yay. Okay, Cassie, Sellers Rec.
Hi, this is Cassandra Sellers Rec. I'm here. I am with the Cowlitz Indian Tribe. I am an elected official from there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cassandra. Aru Hedrick?
I am here. I am a psychiatrist at Vancouver Clinic, and I'm representing physicians in Clark County, and I'm also part of the PAC Executive Council.
Thank you. And we have Dr. Alan Melnick as an ex officio member.
I'm here, and like Council Chair Bowerman, I am now one of two ex officio members on PAC.
And that is great. Thank you, everyone. Is there anyone on the phone or on Zoom that I'm not seeing that has not been called upon? Other than I know we have the leadership team from the health department, but any other PAC members or guests? Hearing none, we'll move on. The first thing that we're going to do in terms of our business for tonight is to review, if you haven't already, but you probably have, our minutes from December 14th. So has anybody not received them at all? I think they made their way to everyone. So not hearing that anyone has not, we'll go ahead and I'll call for a motion to approve those minutes.
Motion to approve. There's a couple misspelled words in there you want to correct. Other than that, I move to approve.
Great. Thank you for that. And do we have a second?
I'll second.
Thank you. And thanks, Sandy. Lydia, did you get those?
I did. Thank you. Remy moved and Sandy second. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And do we have a quorum, Lydia?
Yes, we most definitely do.
I thought we would have quite a while ago, just making sure. Okay. I'm going to go quickly through the agenda and just to kind of call out what is coming next. So I don't hear that we have anybody here that wishes to make a public comment or a visitor. So we'll go then into the, taking a quick look to see if I've missed anything, the department updates. And tonight we'll be hearing a budget update from Jeff Harbison. Dr. Melnick is going to be bringing us up to date on COVID-19 and House Bill 1152 and some of the implications for our work as a Public Health Advisory Council. And then I will just introduce and open a discussion about where we want to go in 2022. And then we'll have an executive committee update. The main business there is that at our last meeting, we presented the slate of candidates for officer roles in 2022. And so really the only business we have left to secure those slots are to have a vote, and we'll take care of that toward the end of the meeting. And there's one other item of business that we need to cover, and that is we're going to talk briefly about the possibility of changing our meeting day from Tuesday to possibly Wednesday. Sounded like the next most likely one to work, but people are going to have an opportunity to provide feedback both tonight and also if you need to check your calendar and think about it, you can get back to Lydia by the end of the month. So that'll be coming up at the end of the meeting. So then any comments about any of that before we jump right into our department updates? I don't think I've missed anything, but if I do, feel free to let me know. So we'll start with the 2022 budget update from Jeff Harbison. And thanks for being here, Jeff.
Yes, thank you, Marla. So I believe I discussed the 2022 budget at the last meeting, but I will provide some updates on that as well as talking about the 2023 budget process. Budget was approved by the council in November of 2021. That's the 2022 operating budget. With that budget was a significant increase to our state foundational public health services, or FPHS, grant revenue. That funding actually started with the state fiscal year, so last July. We were finally notified of the formalized amount very late last year. So we're still filling positions. However, we're being strategic in spending that grant money down on other qualifying expenses like ongoing COVID response. The next part of the budget will be our supplemental process where we'll do any cleanup. For example, there's no COVID response budget in 2022's budget. So that'll be in the supplemental. 2023 budget, FAC is going to be engaged for the first time at a much higher level. Alan will talk about that when he talks about House Bill 1152. Just to update you on timelines around the 2023 budget, we'll be receiving our baseline budget late May, and our budget is actually due August 15th. So we'll have a pretty compressed timeline of getting the budget ready to present any decisions made about new funding, any potential general fund reduction directives, and we'll be engaging FAC throughout that budget process. I've not talked to the rest of our leadership team or Dr. Melnick, but I think possibly a presentation on our budget process itself, the process we use, would be a good idea prior to that work starting with FAC. It's a very comprehensive process, including calculations of environmental health fees, which is a large funding stream for us. And the decision by the Board of Health on those fees plays a significant role in the rest of our budget. We had a couple of years where the Board of Health would not entertain fee increases, and that basically led to us having to shift general fund revenue to environmental public health, and that obviously pulled general fund revenue from other critical services. But the last couple of years, fees have been approved, and we're thankful for that. So I guess if there are any questions on the budget process or the 2022 budget or upcoming 2023 budget, I would take those now. Dr. Melnick will definitely discuss the increased engagement with House Bill 1152 around our budget process. FAC definitely plays a much heavier role now.
Jeff, I have a quick question. What is the audit cycle? Is it 2 years, 3 years?
We're actually audited every year.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Excellent question. Thank you. Now, state auditors, they audit the county annually. It doesn't mean that they come around to every department annually. So, yes, we talk to them every year. There's an entrance, some questions about any significant changes to our operations or key personnel, but they don't always pull grants from us. We're also audited by numerous granting agencies, Department of Health, Department of Division of Children, Youth, and Families, Department of Social and Health Services, Healthcare Authority, et cetera, et cetera.
Other questions for Jeff?
Well, I'm looking forward to going through a budget process with the FAC this year.
I think that'll be great. I feel like you've done an excellent job, though, in the years that I've been on TAC, providing us with regularly occurring budget updates, the rationale behind decisions that are being made, where the money's coming from, or where funds are needed. And so that's been very helpful heretofore. And I think that as we go forward and FAC has a more active role, it'll just even be better. So hopefully FAC will be better able to assist and not just to be hearing the information. So that would be great. Thank you, Jeff.
Yep.
So the next thing we have Dr. Melnick presenting a COVID-19 update, and then immediately after that, you're on the agenda for the House Bill 1152 presentation or update. Thank you, Dr. Melnick.
Good evening. I know it's a challenge for me, but I'll try to be as succinct as possible for both of these items. So if I look up, like I'm looking to the side, I'm looking at my other screen here with the notes I have. So I apologize, but I love being in this virtual environment. So nationally, there's some good news on COVID-19. Nationally, I was just on a call with the CDC, I think yesterday, and the case rates are going down nationally, as well as the hospitalizations. The only downside is that the death numbers are still going up. And that's generally what we see. The hospitalizations lag behind the cases, and then the deaths lag behind that. And what I had heard is that the rate of increase is dropping. So hopefully we're going to be peaking and then decreasing around deaths in the United States. Statewide, the number is going down as well, but the case rate is being come down, but the numbers remain really high. And the 14-day rate statewide is, and this is through January 25th, we have data from, is about 3,053 per 100,000 over 14 days. You know, back in the highest, rate level of Delta, this is about, this Omicron surge is about six times greater in terms of rates. So the rates are ridiculously high. The reason I think we're not seeing more hospitalizations than we are, although the hospitals are pretty stressed out statewide, is that Omicron tends to be milder, but the amount of transmission, the case numbers kind of make up for that. I think if we had a variant, if Omicron were as caused as much disease as severe disease as Delta, we'd be seeing a very different picture right now. And I'll get into the Clark County numbers in a second. The 7-day rate hospitalization for the state is about 30 new admissions per 100,000 population. You know, you extrapolate that to Clark County, that would be 150 admissions in a week. That's a lot. 28% of hospital beds statewide, so more than 25% are occupied by COVID-19 patients. In Clark County, our rates are fortunately coming down. For the last 2 weeks, they've been, the 14-day rate has been coming down. We're now down, our highest rate, we were at like 2549 per 100,000. We're now down to 2409. So the numbers are really high, but thankfully they're coming down. And again, that's about the highest rate we had in during the Delta surge was about 550. So we're at 2409. But it's getting better. The hospitalization rates remain high. Our 7-day rate of hospitalization per 100,000 is 19. So better than the state, but still pretty high. Right now, the latest numbers I have, 94%, the hospitals are at high occupancy rates. So 94% of hospital beds are occupied. And 98% of ICU beds are occupied. That's concerning because, you know, when the ICU beds get filled, I mean, where do people with heart attacks, you know, go? So 24%, about a quarter of all hospital beds are occupied by patients with COVID-19 and people are under investigation for COVID-19. And about a little under a third of our ICU beds now, 30%, are occupied by COVID-19 patients or those under investigation. We got currently 122 patients hospitalized in Clark County for related to COVID-19. The numbers show consistently that case rates, hospitalization rates, and death rates are several times higher among those who are unvaccinated compared to fully vaccinated, even as we're, as we're going through the Omicron surge here. And this is true in Clark County, it's true statewide, and it's true nationally. So in Clark County through late January, and that's well into the Omicron surge, the case rate was more than six times higher and the unvaccinated compared to the vaccinated. I just want to mention this because there's messaging going on, you know, including social media saying that people who are vaccinated are just as likely to transmit infection. While people who are vaccinated are less likely to get infected, so they're therefore less likely to transmit it. I just wanted to make that point. The hospitalization rate is 5.5 times greater in Clark County among unvaccinated compared to vaccinated, and the death rate is nearly 7 times higher. And that's through late January. The vaccines continue to be very effective at preventing illness and hospitalization in youth. And, you know, now 5 and older are eligible to be vaccinated. And 12 and older are eligible for a booster dose. Pfizer is working on an emergency use authorization for children 6 months through 4 years, I should say. But the vaccine is not yet authorized, but I think we'll be seeing that fairly soon. I believe the FDA advisory committee is meeting on the 15th. And then we would still need the FDA to authorize it, the CDC to vote on it, and then the Western State Scientific Group votes on it. But that should be happening, I believe, within the next couple of weeks. In terms of data for vaccinations, we now have data on everybody on the 5 and older population. I didn't have them last month. Statewide, the proportion of people, of all eligible people, eligible to be vaccinated, statewide, 70% of those are 5 and older are vaccinated, fully vaccinated. Clark County is at 64%. So I point out, you know, more than one-third of the eligible population in Clark County is unvaccinated. In Clark County, the proportion of children 5 to 11—statewide, the proportion of kids 5 to 11 who are fully vaccinated is 27%, a little bit over a quarter. And in Clark County, it's 20%. So 27% of Clark County 5 to 11 have had one dose. And then a lot of boosters have been given statewide and in Clark County. Statewide, 2.5 million. In Clark County, we've done 144,000. A new report from the CDC shows that while the Delta and Omicron variants were circulating, case and hospitalizations were highest among people who were unvaccinated and lowest among people who were fully vaccinated and who had received a booster dose. So we strongly recommend boosters. Same thing, a report looked at case and hospitalization rates in Los Angeles from November through this past January, and rates are so we're looking at Omicron here. The rates are consistently higher for unvaccinated people and lowest for people who are vaccinated and boosted. Anyway, I can go on and on. During the most recent week, when Omicron was a predominant strain occurring, the case rate was 3.6 times higher in unvaccinated compared to those who are vaccinated and boosted, and the hospitalization rate was 23 times higher. So we're consistently seeing this. The other point I want to make, and, you know, you hear information about this, there is really good science around masking and masking in terms of preventing infection. And the reason I'm going through this is that, we maintain our Facebook page, and we hear a lot. You know, if you ever go to our Facebook page, you can see a lot of the information and misinformation that's circulating around on social media sites. So a new report from the CDC shows that consistent use of masks in indoor public setting is associated with the lower odds of being infected, of testing positive. They looked at indoor mask use among California residents from February through December, and the mask use in indoor settings for 652 people who tested positive and 1,176% of people who tested negative. And they found that people who consistently wore masks were less likely to get COVID-19. 56% less likely for people who wore cloth masks, 66% less likely for people who wore surgical masks, and 83% lower for people who wore respirators like N95s and KN95s. Okay, just want to mention briefly, we're working on getting test kits out to the community. We've been working with CRESA and community partners, serving priority populations to get distributed at-home tests and masks, and we're working with a BIPOC community-based organizations to help get those out. We received the first order of test kits from the state, and we've already distributed, I believe we've got, our partners have distributed around 16,000 test kits into the community, including a variety of methods, including food distribution, community events, and even one-on-one interactions. I think, Michelle, I think you've been part of some of those efforts as well. I know that LULAC was involved.
We did a vaccine clinic, but also as the project manager for the Macaw project, I know that we've been giving out a lot of, when we do vaccine clinics, we've been distributing the COVID tests after you receive a vaccine with an incentive. And the outreach on that, when they get the test kit, has been so overwhelmingly welcomed. But especially once they receive, it's not like we just give them a test. And then they're just like, you know, we send them off into the sunset. How we do it is they go in to get their vaccine. They get their vaccine, and then we survey with the HRSA grant. And they get their incentive, but we also give them test kits for their family. And with that, we give them another flyer that says what to do if you do get COVID, and explain how the COVID tests work. Because it's no sense if you give somebody a test and they don't know how to use it, especially in the BIPOC community. So those have been really welcomed in the BIPOC communities.
Definitely appreciate community partnerships here and getting, and that vaccine clinic was great. So
just in the last month in January, just my CDWs, just our own, just for reporting, we vaccinated 230 people in January.
That's great.
And that's like first time vaccinations, like whole families of eight coming in, getting their first vaccination. So it's been going well.
Thanks, Michelle. I just want to mention, folks are probably aware of this, that you can also order masks from the, there's two web portals. One is the federal one. It's called www.covidtests.gov. You get one kit of four per household. And then Washington Department of Health has the site called www.sayyescovidhometest.org. You've probably all seen that. And you get one kit with four to five tests per household. And we have this information on our website. And then Public Health and CRESA placed orders for masks to distribute to community partners. And I think partners received their mask orders last week and are working to distribute them throughout the communities. I see Michelle nodding her head, so she, yeah, you got some.
When I got the one pallet, like, I got a pallet of 40,000 masks. Do you know what that looks like? And they were like, Michelle, where do you want it delivered? And my husband's like, not at the house.
So, yeah. So the other thing is local pharmacies are going to be beginning to distribute free N95 masks as well. And then the last thing I want to mention on the COVID update is that we're still working on getting vaccines to high-risk groups, particularly adult family homes. That's a homebound population where, you know, people can't go out in a high-risk population. And as well as not only residents of adult family homes, but long-term care facilities, homebound residents, and people who are unhoused. So we're setting up mobile points of dispensing. They're called mobile pods, involving volunteers, Medical Reserve Corps. And we visited so far 194 adult family homes We've administered 1,008 doses of vaccine, 958 were boosters or third doses, and 602 volunteer hours. So volunteers are doing an incredible amount of work in terms of getting vaccine to those populations. So that's it for the update. I don't know if folks have any questions.
What was that second point you made?
Second point about...
No, I was just kidding. I was just...
Sorry.
Marty.
I'm on a roll here, so...
I know, that was a lot of...
Got me there, Michelle. I think Tyler's got a question.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for that detailed update. I appreciate it. The one question I have is I saw that Oregon and now California both are dropping mask mandates, and are you anticipating that Washington State is going to alter it as well?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm sure I'll be getting a lot more of that question. The interesting one is Oregon, I think their date is March 31st, which is a ways away. So I think that's a bit, and the California one, I think they're dropping it for, they're dropping it for fully vaccinated folks, if I remember hearing correctly, but not for the unvaccinated. I'm not sure how that's going to work out. I haven't heard anything from the state of Washington yet. I think the governor has regular press conferences, so we might hear more. But in my discussions with my counterparts across the state, as well as the State Department of Health leadership, I haven't heard of any plan to do that at this point. And I'd point out that our case rate right now, it's interesting we're having these discussions. We're all optimistic about the numbers going down, but our case rate is still ridiculously high, and our hospitals are still really full. And, you know, I got to say, like, several months ago, I'd never heard of Omicron. So I am cautiously optimistic that things are going to get better and we will get there soon. But, I'm giving you a long-winded answer, Tyler, but I haven't heard anything from DOH or the governor's office yet. I think that answers that. Sometimes I wish the communication was a little bit better, or, you know, we'd get a little bit of a head notice, but that doesn't always happen. I think Cassandra has a question.
Hi, this is Cassie. In my personal life, I'm a critical care nurse and work in ECMO, and I am reassured by your comment. We are exhausted in the hospital systems, and it's a scary thought to me to have more unsafeness. So thank you for your mindfulness when it comes to this, Dr. Mellick.
Well, thanks, Cassie. And, you know, the main reason I point out, I mean, the vaccines do prevent a significant amount of transmission, but the main reason for really pushing on vaccinations is to preserve our healthcare system. And actually the people who work there as well, because, you guys, first of all, I really want to say I appreciate, everything you do, you and your colleagues do. People are getting burned out at this. So, you know, looking at the difference in hospitalization rates, between, unvaccinated and vaccinated, we really need to, get that word out. And I think if you have a chance, the January 26th, I think it was January 26th, Board of Health meeting, we had representatives from Peace Health and Legacy, as well as the Vancouver Clinic. They're on a panel speaking to the Board of Health, and I thought they did a really good job of getting some of that information out there. But thank you, Cassie, for sharing that.
Any other questions for Dr. Mellick about the COVID update? I see Emma's hand up.
Yep. So what's the distribution like in terms of the treatments like Paxlovid? I know that manufacturing has not been fast, but I guess looking forward, what is the availability of treatment options like at the moment?
Yeah, and I'll mention Sotrovimab also, which is the monoclonal antibody that's effective against Omicron. I'm not prepared with the numbers today, but the supplies for both Paxlovid, which is antiviral, basically, by the way, Paxlovid needs to be given within 5 days of onset, and so it needs to be given right away. We can get you the information about which providers, have supply, but it's really limited. I think production is gearing up, but the amount of Paxlovid statewide is pretty limited. Same thing with the sotrovimab, and the monoclonal antibody has to be given within 10 days, and both of these have to be given before people are sick enough to be, in the hospital or their oxygen levels start dropping. But the numbers right now, unfortunately, are still fairly small.
Okay, thanks.
Peggy's got a question.
Thanks, Dr. Melnick. Do you have any updates from the State Board of Health around vaccination requirements for school kiddos?
That's a really great question. As you know, there was a demonstration at the State Board of Health meeting, and they weren't discussing vaccination requirements. They were actually looking at modernizing the rules, the WACs around HIV, I believe. But there was you might have seen it in the news, there was a demonstration there. So the question is COVID-19 vaccination going to be, I think that's what you're asking, are they going to add that to the school requirements, just like, the crimes of measles, mumps, rubella, and so forth, the other vaccine preventable disease requirements for schools. They may be working at that at some point. I don't think that's going to happen. So I don't have them with me, but there's a list of criteria that goes into whether a vaccine should be a requirement for school entry. And I can get that for folks if folks want to hear more about it. I don't have it all memorized, but one of the things, I know we discussed this as health officers, is we didn't think it was going to be viable until all those requirements are met, and some of them are, but also the fact that I think while it remains an emergency use authorization, I think it would be very difficult to add that to the requirement. So I think we'll be looking. I think the State Board of Health may take it up at some point, but I don't think that's happening in the near future. So I don't know whether that answers your question or not. But our recommendation was that we wait, the health officers, when we all got together as a group, that we wait a bit longer on that.
Thank you.
Michelle, is that a new hand?
That's a new hand. I was wondering, do you have any word on the state whether or not we will get any more funding for COVID relief?
That's a really good question. I think it also depends on the feds and the federal funding, because a lot of the funding we got through the CARES Act and ARPA was actually federal funding. We've got more funding, and we're going to be speaking to you all about it, through Foundational Public Health Services funding, and that is state funding. But I haven't heard, Jeff, you might be able to answer this question.
I was going to say, our two ELC, which is ELC, which stands for Epidemiology and Lab Capacity Grants, have been extended. So it's not new funding, but they carried over existing funding that we have not spent yet. We also have $2.5 million of ARPA funding that the council approved for ongoing COVID response. We've been spending state FPHS funding. Again, year one, we received that notice of that funding very late in the game. So instead of sending money back to the state, we're allocating some COVID funding, some COVID costs there. FEMA funding, I believe right now, is going to expire in June if they don't extend. That covers 100% of mass vaccination efforts only. So we use the different sources based on what they will or will not cover. Right now, we're not running low on COVID funds, but on the horizon, we definitely should be, unless something is extended.
Right, because I thought we were, February 11th, they were reevaluating the CARES funding.
That's federal funding.
Federal funding.
Yep, CARES Act.
And we haven't heard anything?
Jeff, have you? I haven't heard.
I've heard nothing on that.
Yeah.
By the way, one other thing we will be doing, and this is happening statewide as well, I'm waiting for more written state guidance, but we all agree that with case numbers like this and with the short incubation with Omicron, that for the general public, case investigation, contact tracing is not very effective, if effective at all. So we're going to be moving, we are already moving back from that and concentrating on efforts and our resources on outbreaks, especially outbreaks at high-risk settings like healthcare outbreaks, congregate settings like shelters or long-term care facilities, jails, places like that, or shelters. I mentioned that. That's where we're concentrating our efforts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we're all exhausted. Do we all look like me? The nurses, the doctors, Dr. Melnick, do we all have dark circles under our eyes?
Hey, hanging out with all of you invigorates me, believe it or not. So, I mean, your work and your support mean so much. So this is actually, I'm not making this up. This makes me feel better. So community support is great. We have a really great community to work in spite of all the, you know, some of the other stuff you may hear from time to time.
Mm-hmm. As we're moving towards infection prevention work, that is really more of a strategic sort of pivot from case and contact investigation, like Dr. Melnick was talking about. And really our focus now going forward, we are going to have a team that's going to continue to work with our long-term care facilities and our adult family homes and healthcare provider partners and our other community partners to really work on infection prevention processes and protocols, and we have a team of just outstanding nurses that's going to continue to work in that regard and really help folks to build these protocols in place so that another situation like this comes about, we will be better situated to manage some of the outbreaks that we've been seeing. So one of the things that we have found is, as we've gone through this, is that a lot of organizations have a lot of turnover, and a lot of the protocols and processes that really should be in place are not necessarily kept up or trained very well. So that's another way that we're going to be sort of a partner and help to support our our partners in the community.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Have you seen more outbreaks in certain living conditions than others?
Yeah, and we, you know, right now we've got around 50 outbreaks going. Many of them are in healthcare facilities, like long-term care facilities. And, you know, the definition of an outbreak, you know, if you have a resident in a long-term care facility, is it's one or more. So, because of, you know, the concern there, we've got a number of outbreaks that our team is working on, going on at the same time. So yes. Long-term care facilities, you know, nursing homes, adult assisted living facilities, adult family homes, or, well, not so much adult family homes because those are small, but mm-hmm. some of those other facilities are, yes. The answer is yes.
Yeah.
I have a question. This is Aru. I'm going to ask you to speculate a little bit here. So, you know, we've been hearing that perhaps Omicron is the variant that has, it's obviously spread through the population like a wildfire, and perhaps this is the variant that is, has, you know, essentially vaccinated a whole bunch of people, right? And so is this the transition from a pandemic to the endemic stage of COVID? And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Wow, we have a real optimist in our group here, so that's great. You know, and our physician members.
After 2 years, we need something to hold on to.
Yeah, so I'm going to go out on a limb here and speculate. So what we've seen with previous versions of the SARS, you know, the SARS-CoV-2 virus is that I hate to use the word natural infection because natural sounds, you know, like, unnatural sounds like a pejorative term. So infection-induced immunity. What we've seen with other variants is that infection induced immunity is not long standing with SARS-CoV-2. So, you know, the answer, I mean, right now, when you're thinking about what we've got going here is, you know, and our 14-day case rate is 2,500 per 100,000. That means 2.5% of our population is infected at any time within those 2 weeks. So we're seeing, you're right, you know, between vaccination and infection, although there's some overlap because we've got breakthroughs as well, that we're getting a large proportion of our population has seen, you know, the spike protein, so to speak, and should have some immunity. What we've seen so far is that, again, I'm not a national expert or virologist on this, but we've seen before is that vaccination is more protective against infection than previous infection. And, I'd be really speculating on whether that's going to be the case with Omicron. But I think that, you know, I think that remains to be seen. My gut feeling is, sorry about that phone ringing in the background. I have no way of shutting it off. Okay. I think I'll do one more ring. Oh, good. Oh. Okay. Sorry about that. It's hard to speculate that, but my main message right now is that people really need to get vaccinated, even if they've been infected in the past. Right now, the data is showing us that for those who've been previously infected, and of course, the data are older than Omicron. For people who've been previously infected, those who are vaccinated have a lower risk of reinfection than those who are unvaccinated. That may be the case, Aru, but my main recommendation for people who've been infected is to get vaccinated and get boosted. Yeah. And maybe they have some, like, hyperimmunity because they've had both, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Vaccination is key. Also, can you comment, is there still the recommendation to wait 90 days from for someone who is not vaccinated, if they are infected with COVID, are they still wanting people to wait 90 days to get the vaccine after an infection?
No, they never. That was never a recommendation. I think what you're hearing is that if you've had an infection in the past 90 days, you don't have to quarantine if you're exposed. I think that the recommendation is if you've been infected, is if you've recovered, you can go ahead and get the vaccine, you know, so you don't have to wait 90 days after getting, infection to get vaccinated.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think that was true before. I think it, you know, all these nuances get so confusing, but yeah. We don't want people to get the vaccine while they're still sick with COVID-19, though. You need to be recovered.
And if someone's gotten the antibody treatment, I think they're still a waiting period.
Yep. And I'm trying to remember what the waiting period is. And I think it's longer than 90 days, but you're taxing me on that one. But you definitely have to wait because the antibodies will block. I think it's longer than 90 days. I'm going to have to look. I could look it up by the time we're done with this and tell you what the exact time period is.
Okay. Thank you, Alan.
That's definitely true. If you get monoclonal antibodies, you're going to have to wait.
Any other questions before we shift gears? These are great questions, though. I'm really pleased with all the thoughts that are coming forward here. Okay, I'm not hearing any. So, okay, Dr. Melnick, it might be time to switch over to House Bill 1152. And thank you so much for such a great overview of what's going on with COVID right now. It's just still very much on everyone's minds. And I don't think we're ready to relax yet. So it's helpful to get the latest information. Thank you.
Thanks. I've talked about COVID-19 so much. I was looking at my notes, but I don't, that's mainly for the updated numbers. So So House Bill 1152, it actually has a statute associated with it since it passed, and I probably should have listed that. But for those of you who are interested in public health law, and I can't get enough of it, the statute that resulted from House Bill 1152 is RCW. So the public health statutes are all in Chapter 70.05, just so if you want to be regaled with that. It's Title 70. Actually, it's in Title 70, but the particular statute for this is, and actually, thank you, Roxanne, it is 90 days for the post-antibody, so Aru was correct, which I thought so, but I didn't want to go out on a limb there. Roxanne just texted me and reminded me. So the statute is now 70.05.035. So if you just Google RCW 70.05.035, and basically what it says is, and I'm not going to go into the history of House Bill 1152 on this statute, but basically for home rule charter counties like Clark County, the Board of Health historically has been made up of the elected officials. In our case, the county council is the Board of Health, but previously, the Board of Commissioners is the Board of Health. And the statute says, the new statute basically said the county legislative authority, which is our Board of Health, the membership must also include some non-elected members. And the number of electeds can't exceed the number of non-electeds. And the simplest these non-elected members need to be drawn from three categories. One is people from public healthcare facilities and providers. It's a broad category. It includes medical ethicists, physicians, community health workers, physicians assistants, nurses, dentists, on and on and on. It's a full list. You can go into the statute and see it. Another group needs to be consumers of public health, and those are and it actually, if you read the statute, it basically says county residents who have self-identified as having faced significant health inequities or having lived experience with public health related programs. Such as underrepresented communities are given preference. So, and thanks for putting the RCW into the chat so you can look at it. Some of you can look at it while I'm yakking here. And then the other group, the third group is other community stakeholders, which are from community-based organizations, active reserve or retired armed services members, business community, environmental health regulated community, and by the way, everybody, all these people need to be approved by a majority vote of the board of the elected officials. So and then also, if a federally recognized Indian tribe holds reservation, trust lands, or has usual or accustomed areas within the county, or if a 501c3 organization registered in Washington that serves American Indian and Alaska Native people and provides services within the county, the Board of Health must include a tribal representative selected by the American Indian Health Commission. So that would be, under this new statute from 1152, what the Board of Health would do. But there's an exception to the Board of Health changing their, redoing the structure. And the exception is that a local Board of Health comprised solely of elected officials may maintain its composition if the local health jurisdiction had a public health advisory committee or board with its own bylaws established on January 1st of 2021. And actually,
I already did, thanks.
What was that? Okay, I'm sorry. And actually, in drafting the statute, the legislature actually looked at the Clark County Public Health Advisory Council bylaws in doing so. So by January 1st of 2022, the Public Health Advisory Committee or board must meet the requirements. So if you want to get another statute related to 1152, RCW 70.46.140, we are now public, the FAC is actually in the statute defined as a community health advisory board. We may, you guys may want to change the name to the Clark County Community Health Advisory Board, but again, it's 70.46.140, and I don't know if you want to, yeah, there it goes. Thank you, Peggy. So that's there now. And so we're going to talk about that because FAC does meet that composition. So let me, and this is all needs to be done by January 1st, 2022. Part of that composition is to have a Board of Health member as an ex officio member. And that's why Council Chair, Bowerman is with us today because, we had to have this done by January 1st. And I believe our Board of Health did that and appointed, Council Chair Bowerman to be the ex officio member. So let me go into what this is. So Community Health Advisory Board, I'm not going to read the whole statute, but I'm just going to talk about what you must do because this is where FAC has a bit more going on than it did in the past. You provide input on the selection of administrative officers and health officers. So actually you provide input, and I don't think that's been done before. I'm in one of the I'm a combined administrator and health officer. I think there's two of us left in the state of Washington. There used to be a lot more, but you provide input to the Board of Health on the selection of those positions. The statute directs the FAC to use a health equity framework, which I think you've already established that. But a health equity framework to assess community health needs and review and recommend public health policies and priorities. So you will be recommending policy development as well as priorities for our department, as well as, you know, directing this to the Board of Health as well. Evaluate. You have a role in evaluating the impact of proposed policies and programs. You have a role in terms of promoting public participation and identification of public health needs. You can provide community forums. So if you wanted to hold a community forums and hearings, as assigned, so the Board of Health can actually ask you to conduct community forums and hearings on issues. You can establish community task forces as assigned by the local Board of Health. I think you're getting the message that there's a much tighter tie-in between the Board of Health and FAC that there was before, which is going to be helped by having the liaison ex officio member. And we got an advantage here because it also happens to be the chair of our Board of Health. Review and make recommendation on annual budget and fees, as Jeff was pointing out. So you'll be doing that, and review and advise on our progress in achieving performance measures. So in terms of the composition, I think we meet the composition, or FAC meets the composition. You must have at least 9 to 21 members appointed by the local Board of Health, and we have 20 right now. Lydia or Marla, anybody else, correct me if I'm wrong. We have one vacancy that I think we've already mentioned. But the membership must be diverse and include members with expertise in healthcare access and quality, the physical environment, housing, education, and employment, business and philanthropy, communities that experience inequities, government and tribal government, community members with lived experience in the areas I've mentioned, consumers and community stakeholders, including nonprofit organizations, business community, and those regulated by public health. So I think we have all those, and that's kind of the composition, and we meet that. We have one vacancy right now. Our representative from Peace Health Southwest Medical Center, that position is vacant, but I've had discussions with Peace Health, and they're working on a nomination for that position. So I wanted to be as succinct as possible. That's basically it in a nutshell. I think we're going to see a much closer relationship between FAC and the Board of Health, and more activity for all of you over the next, well, going forward. Go ahead, Peggy.
Any questions?
Does this mean that FAC members will be expected to attend Board of Health meetings?
Yeah, from now on, you have to. No, I'm just kidding. You know, I don't think, you know, some of you have not only attended, but you've also spoken at Board of Health meetings. I think that's always welcome. You know, in terms of, but I think, you know, the great thing about Board of Health meetings is also, and I recommend that you can stream them on CBTV. But I mean, there may be times, you know, when the Board of Health asks you to attend, Board of Health meetings, but there's no requirement that you attend Board of Health. I mean, I think that's the reason why we have the ex officio member from the Board of Health here. So, and, you know, you can always submit written, you've done that before, letters, written comments to the Board of Health as well. But I don't see anything in the statute that says you have to attend, that you will have to attend Board of Health meetings.
Okay, I was just, it almost sounds like they're merging the two together, the FAC and the Board of Health, but they're still two separate entities, correct?
Yeah, so if we didn't have this exemption, it would be kind of merged, but I see an advantage, this is my bias, I didn't write the statute. The advantage I see is that we have a much more larger and robust FAC. I mean, if the Board of Health just added a few positions, you know, based on the statute, they wouldn't get the input that that we have with FAC, because there's, you know, we have more areas, we have a larger group. So I think there's some advantages there, but yeah, the if you don't have the exception for what we have, yeah, it would be a kind of a merged thing. You'd have non-elected members on the Board of Health. And some health districts in the state already have that if they're health districts.
So my comment on that is I think that I believe that that challenges us to step up and be more involved as if we were combined, because that's the one thing that we can decide with the Board of Health how connected we want to be. If we didn't have this exemption, we would have to be connected whether we wanted to or not. I think it would be a wonderful thing if the FAC group and the Board of Health was more closely connected. We can choose to do that if both sides see the value in that. So that would be my wish for a direction that we could go. And that doesn't mean that every single member of FAC has to attend every single Board of Health meeting, but maybe there's a two or three people that are very interested in doing that and can become more regular attendees, just like we now have Councillor Bowerman here with us. Maybe there would be one or two people that would want to try to attend the Board of Health meetings and just create a stronger working relationship across. That's what I'm thinking would be helpful.
And I'm just thinking that when you do come to the Board of Health or if you do testify, please don't identify yourself only by your normal work title, but also with your membership on FAC, because I can tell you that the Board of Health won't know that unless you specifically state it. And I think that is to the benefit of both sides of the equation if you do.
Councilor Bowerman, I'm sorry, I'm thinking that, and I apologize. You know, it's possible that FAC members could be panelists like we did with our healthcare partners at Board of Health meetings as well. Would that be acceptable?
I would think so, yes.
I'm glad you mentioned that, though, because when we submit a letter or something like that, it's really obvious that it's coming from the group, from the Public Health Advisory Council, and I think it would be a good idea, actually, to change the name so it matches the letter of the law. But I do think that it's going to be important that we identify members of this group as being connected to it and part of it, so that the public can see that we are following the legislated arrangement that we want to be part of. So I'm really looking forward to what this can do for both the Board of Health and for the Public Health Department and the Public Health Advisory Council.
And you need not wait to begin. Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. we have our next meeting.
Thank you for that. That's very good to be. It feels good to be invited. Thank you. Other questions for Dr. Melnick? That was great information on a lot of it. Anything, any other thoughts, ideas about this issue? Well, maybe it's time to shift gears again. We have about 20 minutes left and an important topic on the agenda, and it's one that I will be introducing. Was there anything else you wanted to add, Dr. Melnick, before we move on?
I'm good. I think you've heard more than enough from me.
It was perfect. Thank you. So the executive committee meets in advance of this meeting. And in that meeting, there was what I could tell was a really robust discussion. I unfortunately did not attend that meeting, and I was really regretting it, but because it sounded like it was a great conversation. And so what was discussed was, what do we want to do in this new year? There are certain things that the Clark County Public Health already knows it needs to focus on. Those main three things are foundational public health services, which are things that have to occur whether you're in the middle of a pandemic or you have lots of leisure time, which the public health department would never have. Then another one is the pandemic, because we know it's going to be with us for a while. And then the third thing is racial equity, which we have really made, I hope, some very bold claims about where we want to be and what we need to do to get there. But I still think there's a lot of work to be done to figure out, to be clear about that, articulate that, and then be mindful of how to get from here to there. We have a ways to go. So with those three focus areas in mind, what I am here to do is to invite all of you members of the Public Health Advisory Council to begin a conversation about our work plan for 2022. And the year is just chugging by really fast, so there's no time like the present to start to put some thoughts and ideas on paper and create a plan together collaboratively with the public health department. But our role is distinct in that we are charged to provide recommendations and advisory information to the Board of Health, and I believe that as a result of that, we are better partners with the health department. So I'd like to open up the discussion right now and ask all of the members of Public Health Advisory Council, and maybe with a little extra support from the executive committee that did attend the meeting, and that would be particularly Aru and Sandy and Michelle, to speak up in terms of your thoughts, having had a chance to have conversation about this. And then, of course, to any and all of you, if you have thoughts and ideas about where you think we can do better or course correct or move in a direction that you think would be best to serve the folks that we are here to serve. So let's open it up. And who would like to go first?
Well, this is Sandy. I guess I can go first. And my ideas and thoughts during our executive committee were more general, that knowing that we have these three areas that we need, that the health departments, our public health is working on, In the past, we've always had some speakers that come and educate us about other kinds of things around public health that are occurring. And because I represent consumers, I'm always interested in other kinds of things that we're thinking about around public health. And the one that I hear a lot about and I'm also involved with is around local food systems and local food access and the impact that that has on families and health in our community. So that would be one of my suggestions and not necessarily something we might have to spend or want to spend a lot of time on, but to educate ourselves as a staff in a little bit more about food access and food systems and how that affects health overall in our community. So, and then just adding some of those other kinds of speakers that might come in and educate us as a group or give us more information about a variety of things besides the focus that we might be working on. Because I know we always have a focus that we're working on that, you know, we need to deal with every meeting. But there's also a lot of other outlying issues there that would be nice to be aware of.
This is Aru. I can also go next year. So I also had more general thoughts around things that we could focus on or, as Sandy said, be, you know, educate ourselves more on. And one of my interests has, you know, always been the mental health impact of COVID. And so whether we want to focus on that or if there's, you know, speakers who can talk about this, I'm actually attending a talk in a couple of weeks. One of the clinicians from OHSU is going to be talking about pediatric mental health in the age of COVID. So just kind of thinking about mental health and substance use and, you know, how, I mean, there's also lots of, you know, interconnectedness with, you know, homelessness, for example, and just, you know, kind of thinking about that and how, FACT could potentially make a difference there.
I'll go next. I love those topics, Aru. Thank you. But I also was thinking racial equity and tying that in. You know, I also deal with under-resourced communities, BIPOC communities, but even just not even so much if we don't include all the BIPOC, just across the board, housing. You know, under racial equity, there's a lot of, you know, the housing issues of Vancouver and what that may look like. I think that one is that encompasses a lot of different things. That encompasses mental health, access to healthcare, transportation, is, you know, food sovereignty or insecurities. I think housing would be a really big topic, and we could, you know, what was discussed in the executive council meeting was that we could really pull from different departments in the health and department of in public health. So that is one thing I would like to explore.
Yeah, thank you, Michelle. This is Aru again. I also wanted to say, you know, I mean, FACT has has also, like last year, we did talk about racism as a public health crisis. And I think, you know, the issue of housing and homelessness and, you know, mental health and substance use and how and the pandemic itself, how they've disproportionately affect, you know, the BIPOC community. So I think that would be really important, you know, I think issue if FACT wanted to focus on that, thinking about racial equity. I think that would be amazing if we wanted to focus on that. There's so much to do there, and I know there's a lot, you know, already happening in the community. So I think we, you know, certainly don't have to reinvent the wheel here. I think there's a lot of community partners that we could work with as well.
Just to follow up on that, Aru, I just think, you know, how impactful to be a voice for those people that don't ever feel that government or local government is their voice.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I really like what you said, Aru. I like all the suggestions that are coming out there, particularly as they tie in the our desired work around racial equity. But I think you said it well. We don't have to reinvent the wheel on a lot of these things because we're very blessed, in my opinion, to have a community that's very rich with agencies that are highly skilled and talented in focusing on certain kinds of problems that people face. And some of them have already been named. I'm particularly have a passion for people that are unhoused and how difficult that must be. It's like almost nothing else can work if you don't have an address and don't have a safe shelter. So, but we have an expert, you know, we have more than one expert organization, Council for the Homeless being one, and Shona can be a great resource for us in this kind of conversation because she's very familiar with many organizations that I might not know about. So that's sort of my thought is how do we leverage other already very skillful organizations to help all of us get to the place that we're all trying to go.
Yeah, and we'd also love to hear ideas from other FAC members too. You know, these are some ideas and thoughts that our executive council talked about, but you know, these are certainly not the only ones that we could focus on. So we'd love to have, you know, others, you know, have come up with ideas and have discussion around that.
Mm-hmm. And we're not going to get this done tonight. So if you think of things after the meeting, because we're going to be coming up on our time pretty soon, jot them down. You can send an email to Lydia saying, here's some thoughts I had about this topic. Capture those thoughts while they're coming through your mind so they don't get lost because I think we really need to spend some time on this discussion soon so that we can begin to create a solid work plan.
Whatever you all decide to work on, we can get you information and data, you know, if you need information to support what you're working on, we're at your service.
That would be great. And maybe we can form a couple of committees where people break up into smaller groups and tackle some of these things in, you know, not trying to do it all with a large group. Anything else that somebody wants to
help? I think Cassie has her hand up.
Oh, great. Thanks. Go ahead, Cassie.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I appreciate hearing the ideas. I think that there is always a time and a place to talk about the underserviced and the underprivileged. And I don't hear enough talk about Native American issues, sovereignty issues, issues with bias. I have over the years been discouraged with Clark County and the amount of racism our own tribe has experienced this when we were trying to buy back our land, which is an egregious thing that we have to do. And so I think continuing that conversation and always having that conversation about the inequity in health when it comes to people of color and especially mental health issues. In this time of COVID, mental health is worse than ever. Domestic violence is worse than ever. The amount of things that we see in the hospital due to mental health is egregious and heartbreaking, and sometimes people are beat into unrecognizable states, and it's due to the mental health issues. And so I think that it's really important to stay mindful and stay focused on those who are marginalized. It's easy to see that people who are successful all look the same. And having that conversation is essential. And I feel like where much is given, much is expected. And people with privilege, it's exciting to hear that conversation continue. And really, it's essential. So I appreciate hearing that. And I know from our own community, there is lots of need. And so partnering and that collaboration is really important. So thank you.
Thank you for that, Cassie. I know you're completely overwhelmed right now with your work, but I hope that you'll be with us as much as you can as we go forward with the conversation.
Absolutely. I myself probably lost a year and a half with COVID crying because of what I've had to do. So, it's just really highlighted. Maybe the inhumane part of society. And so to continue to advocate and have strong voices is really important. And I appreciate the work that everyone's doing.
Hey, Cassie, this is Alan. You're still working in the ICU, correct?
That's correct. I work in the neurotrauma ICU running ECMO and COVID positive patients and in the Emmanuel emergency room. I worked in the emergency room yesterday, and it's overwhelming and heartbreaking and busier than ever.
Well, thank you for that, Cassie. I think that's actually a good place to shift gears, because I think we kind of need to sit with that right now. And it's a really big deal. So I'm excited about the fact that we have an opportunity to really make a difference this year. And I think that the new structure is going to strengthen our ability to do that. So that I honor everyone's time and your willingness to be here, I want to move on in the agenda, and the next item that we need to accomplish is to have a vote on our slate of candidates. So in the last meeting, we presented the slate of candidates for the chair for this coming year, Dr. Aru Undurti Hedrick, Vice Chair Sandy Brown, Member at Large Michelle Stickley. And these candidates go together as one unit. So what we will be voting on is yes or no to having this slate go forward and serve for this year. And it was one suggestion that came to me was, if people think that the folks that are going to be voted on should not be present while we vote, we had a discussion about that 2 years ago. One way we accomplished that is that they could turn off their audio. We'll probably do a verbal vote, and that they wouldn't hear who said what or whatever. But the way we usually do a vote like this is we call for someone to make a motion and a second, and then we'll ask, all in favor. And for those opposed, we ask that you say your name so that we can count the number of oppositional votes. I don't think we're going to have a lot of those in this situation. So I want to go ahead then and say, are we ready to take the vote? And I'm comfortable with the folks that we're voting on to decide whether they want to observe it or not. Does anybody have a problem with that? Not breaking any rules, am I? I've been known to do that. Okay, then. Let's go ahead and ask for someone to make a motion that we approve the slate of candidates as it's been presented.
This is Cassandra Sellers-Rex. I will move to approve.
And so I'm hearing that as a motion. Do we have a second?
Second. Remy.
Okay. Then all in favor, say aye.
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 Anyone opposed, say no. And your name. Hearing none, the motion is carried. We have three excellent officers for 2022. Thank you to those who are going to be leading us going forward. And congratulations. And so thank you for that. And there was just one last thing, and that was there was a request made to see if it's possible to change our meeting day, evening, from Tuesday to a Wednesday. I believe Thursday was also asked about, but I believe that one of our officers would not be able to do that. So If you would, please.
Sorry, Marla.
Yes, go ahead.
Thursdays would also work. It was initially me. I thought I couldn't do Thursdays, but I can. So we can include both Wednesday and Thursday.
Perfect. Okay.
So we can include Thursday. That's LULAC night.
Well, so this is why I'm bringing it to you. So what we need is we need to hear from you, and you can notify Lydia, send her an email, but do it soon so you don't forget. And she really needs to get that information by the end of February so that we can move forward and find another night. So please notify. Yes, go ahead, Remy.
Do you want to do a Survey Monkey and just kind of cast a survey over the whole thing and see who can, yes. Who can?
I like that idea. Thank you.
Yes.
Lydia, are you able? I see you're on mute, but is that something that you could do for us?
Yeah, I think we can do like a doodle poll and include Thursdays and Wednesdays and see how that would work for most people.
Well, it sounds like Thursdays won't work from what I heard.
I
think we need to leave Thursday out. Is there any other night? I think right now, is there any other evening that we need to have the phones muted? I think.
Yeah, we're getting a lot of feedback. Can you
mute your phone?
Thank you.
No, it's still unmuted. Mm-hmm. It sounds like so.
Oh, Mark?
Yeah.
Thank you.
So Thursday won't work and Tuesday won't work. Wednesday, we don't know about anybody else on Wednesday. You know, Monday is a possibility also, although nobody seems to like Monday, but maybe a choice of Monday and Wednesday.
So I have a question. So what's the reason that it's not Tuesdays anymore?
The reason it's not Tuesday is that the chair of the Board of Health, who's also our ex officio member, Council Chair Bowerman, is not available. She's got a conflict. When she became chair, she developed a new conflict, but she wants to stay on FAC and is really interested in it. And she's also the chair of the Board of Health. So that's why I think it's a good, this is my bias, but it's good to have the chair of the Board of Health as our ex officio member. So that's the reason for that.
I'll just say that Mondays are city council meeting nights, and they don't work for me a lot of the time. So
Monday won't work.
And Wednesdays are city council meetings for
me. Okay.
So.
These days aren't.
I think we just need to do a Survey Monkey so we see, you know, how great the impact is going to be on the various days. I can't think of another way to gather that information quickly.
And I apologize because you are all important on FAC. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
We'll get a Survey Monkey out to everybody.
Right.
Would it be possible to change the time? Like, I don't, yeah. I couldn't do an hour and a half in the middle of the day, but.
Well, let's see what we, that's a good question. Maybe we need to spend a little more time on this between now and our next meeting by email or something.
I think what we can do is if we get back that we just don't have any good days, we could also consider different times, Peggy, to your point. And maybe there's a lunchtime hour, maybe I'm not exactly sure, but we'll get some preliminary data, and then we'll take it back to the team to see kind of what next steps would be.
Thank you. Great.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Well, we are over our time, 4 minutes. Sorry. I try to really stick to our time because everybody's time is precious, and I appreciate that you're here. I'm going to wrap up the meeting. Is there anything that I have missed on the agenda or anything else that needs to be addressed right now?
Laura, this is Paul.
Hi, Paul.
I would like to thank you very much for the excellent job that you have done as chair. And thank him so very, very much.
It's been my pleasure. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this time with you all. And I'll still be a member, so yay.
Yeah, Paul, you took the words right out of my mouth. I wanted to say a huge thank you to Marla for the amazing job you've done. We've got big shoes to fill, or I've got big shoes to fill, Marla. So thank you for everything you've done, and I'm so glad that you're going to stay on as a member.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's just, I appreciate it very much. It's been, I can't tell you how much I enjoy working with you all on these important things.
And as an ex officio member and staff, can I echo the, you know, the appreciation, Marla, for everything you've done.
Thank you.
Your leadership has been, and through really tough times, I might add. So thank you for that.
It's my pleasure. Well, I want to give you guys all a send-off so we can, you know, we had a great meeting tonight, though, if I may say so myself. My gosh, lots of great input. And we have our new member, our council chair, Karen Bowerman, and I'm really excited about moving forward together with the new legislation. It's just a wonderful time to be involved in this. So thank you, every single one of you, and I hope you have a great rest of the evening. Happy Valentine's Day pretty soon, don't forget. And have a great rest of the week and the rest of the month. And take care, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.